And I identify there's wet grains on a north aspect. Like, that should have right there just like raised the hairs on my neck. But I did a bunch of stability tests and they weren't really reactive, wasn't propagating a lot. It was all loose, kind of low density snow on top. As soon as we get into the couloir and pull up on the wall of it, part of the bowl behind us just spontaneously releases on those wet grains and goes full track almost 2,000 feet through the couloir and right over our ski tails. It also kind of hammered home to me how important all the little small details are to also do perfect, because you're probably not going to get everything right. This is Jason Simons-Jones, and you're listening to the Avalanche Hour podcast.
You are tuned in to another episode of the Avalanche Hour podcast, your source for great conversations within the snow and avalanche community. I'm your host, Caleb Merrill. The Avalanche Hour podcast is proudly presented by VEASAN Avalanche Control, safety through innovation, with additional sustaining support from Gordini. We keep you outside longer. And Open Snow. Visit opensnow.com to get started with a free trial and enter the discount code AVALANCHEPODCAST at checkout to receive 30% off your first year of Open Snow All Access. The goal of this podcast is to create a stronger community through the sharing of stories, knowledge, and news amongst people who have a curious fascination with avalanches. Additional support for today's episode comes from Rec Pack. Maybe y'all can relate to me here. On long, high-output ventures into the backcountry, sometimes I just can't decide what to eat. Or sometimes none of my snacks feel appetizing, but I know I need some calorie replenishment. Heck, sometimes I just forget to pack enough of a lunch. Do you know the feeling? Introducing Rec Pack. Rec Pack is a lightweight, nutritionally complete instant meal that saves space, weight, and time on your next adventure. It has been designed by top endurance sports nutritionists and is packed with 700 calories from high-quality ingredients such as oats, coconut oil, collagen, and minerals to keep you fueled without weighing you down. All you do is add some water, give it a shake, drink it down, and keep moving. They are so light and packable, I've been keeping one in my pack or sled as an emergency backup. If you're on an expedition, you don't have to worry about meal prep or boiling water, but still refuel with the nutrition you need. Find out more or order some today at recpack, that's recpak.co. Back at the end of December, I got to sit down with Jason Simons-Jones to chat about his career as an IFMGA guide, avalanche educator, AMGA instructor team member, and his new role as the A3's recreational education manager. Jason brings many thoughtful insights to the conversations surrounding his approach to guiding in consequential terrain, experiences of running a guide service, and how he approaches integrating the value of outdoor adventures into everyday life. Join us in this conversation. Jason, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Caleb. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. We're recording this on December 29th, kind of closing out 2023 here. How was your holiday?
Holiday was pretty good. Mellow, kind of spent waiting for the snow to start flying here with the slow start to the season.
Yeah, that's kind of been the story across the contiguous western U.S. these days. Alaska's hogging their share of it right now.
Totally, yep. For someone that missed last season while rehabbing a knee, it's been a little bit extra painful for me this year.
No doubt. Yeah. Well, it's a good employment of patience and makes us remember, you know, that it can't always be exactly what we want, and we got to take what we get and make the most of it, right?
Totally. It'll all come. It usually does.
Yeah. Well, Jason, I'm thrilled to have you on the show today. I'm going to give a bit of a high-level background of Jason's path in his career in the snow and avalanche world. Jason grew up in upstate New York. Sounds like kind of on the side of a small ski hill, and so had a love of skiing and snowboarding from a young age, and recalls, you know, getting dropped off after school and kind of the ski hill be in your playground for some after school activities. He's spent most of his career in outdoor education and guiding people through the mountains, had a history with Outward Bound, leading Outward Bound courses in Colorado and beyond, down in California, I believe. And eventually you ended up in Crested Butte. What a cool place Crested Butte is. During his time there, he spent some time as a ski patroller at Crested Butte Mountain Resort. He was one of the forecasters and actually founders of the Crested Butte Avalanche Center. And in 2007, he bought Crested Butte Mountain Guides at the age of 30. Following that, he went through his AMGA training to become a fully certified IFMGA guide, one of the first 100 Americans to get his pin there. And he works as an instructor team member for the AMGA as well. Jason has a ton of experience delivering and managing both recreational and professional avalanche education from a variety of providers. I think that's a pretty unique aspect of Jason's career, is that he's worked with Aerie. You know, Aerie kind of started in that Crested Butte zone in Colorado during those years. And so he was really involved with Aerie, but also teaches for the American Avalanche Institute. He's taught for Silverton Avalanche School. He has a master's degree in organizational leadership from CU Boulder, and more recently has become the new A3 recreational education manager. So he works on recreational avalanche education programming, and I should add that that's a new position for the A3. And so we're going to get into a lot of that here in the next hour. But Jason, what did I miss? I think I missed that you were in a punk band.
Most people do miss that one. I took a little detour there before getting into the outdoors, in my like later high school, college years, and spent some time in like a punk rock metal band and toured around the East Coast, and even had the luck of being able to play the infamous CBGBs in New York City before it closed down. And my life's been somewhat downhill since, I guess. But yeah, thanks. That was quite the intro. You made me sound much more interesting than I think I am.
Well, Jason, how do you define yourself? It's kind of a broad and bit of an existential question, but what would you say?
Yeah, that's a good question to just open the door to this whole podcast. I think I would define myself as like a perpetual maybe learner, and just kind of with a fascinating curiosity of wanting to learn as much as I can about both my environment and myself through my environment. And that's probably mixed with a little bit of that teenage punk rock angst of like not wanting to be put in a box of, this is all I am as a person. I'm just a guide or just a ski patroller or just an avalanche instructor. So it's probably a healthy blend of those two, of like personal curiosity as well as a little bit of angsty resistance to being placed in a box.
That's a great answer. Jason, talk about some of your formative experiences that brought you into the field of guiding, you know, maybe not just ski guiding, but rock and alpine as well. And, you know, what are a couple like kind of key points in your career that stand out to you?
Probably in the very beginning, like I grew up as an athlete playing baseball and football and those things in New England, and as well as skiing on the little ski hill. So like physical activity, I guess, was always a passion of mine, a way of like expression as also challenge and growth to get better at something. And then I kind of went through the lost college year, so to speak. I was a little disillusioned and was doing the band thing. And I kind of lost the connection with athletics at that level, because I wasn't kind of college level athletics. And I was in the central upstate New York, where there's little ski hills, but not much to be inspiring there. So I think I was kind of drifting, to be honest, a little lost partying a lot, more than I should have been, and was in classes that I was being told, you need to learn this stuff so that, you know, 3-4 years from now when you're actually in the field, you'll be able to use it. And I was just like, did not have the attention span for that. And so I registered for an outdoor education course at Cornell University, which was across the street from Ithaca College, where I went to school. And I took a winter travel and survival class, and we packed all our food and we drove somewhere outside of Buffalo is all I remember in the winter. And of course had some like massive nor'easter lake effect snowstorm in Buffalo there, where we got multiple feet of snow in the middle of the woods and nowhere. And we get out to our camp and we're digging snow shelters and all this, and a bunch of college kids. And the program was run by kind of ex-Knowles instructors. And somehow along the way, we'd forgotten most of our food in the process. And we're out there setting up camp in this blizzard, and we realize that like we don't have enough food for the group for the extended time we're out there, and people start freaking out, rightfully so. And I just had this moment of like, wow, this is pretty cool. Like our decisions that we have to make have immediate impacts on our reality right now. And having been this kind of lost, drifting college kid that didn't feel like he had much purpose in the world or could have much impact, I guess, there's something about that experience that just triggered in me this like, oh, this is real. And this is right in front of us. And this has immediate implications right now in my life of how I have to deal with this. And it lit a little bit of a spark, I think, of just capturing my attention and interest in what the whole outdoor career track was like at that time. And we survived. We were hungry and cold, and we came out early. Snowshoed out of there early, of course, because we didn't have enough food, and had a big debrief. And it just stuck with me like, oh, wow, this is an impactful experience that has real consequence. And I don't have to wait for some delayed learning or lesson or reward. It's all kind of right in front of me. And After that, I switched my major to outdoor education. I registered for a Knowles course, and the summer after, I drove across the country and did a 30-day Knowles course on the Olympic Peninsula. And that's where I first went rock climbing in my life. We went to Squamish and we did like a 2-week rock climbing camp in Squamish. And it was along that Knowles course and that rock climbing camp again that I was just like, it just triggered this like for a college kid that's pretty impressionable and lost and looking for what their purpose is in the universe, a way to have impact and purpose in my life and other people's lives, and also doing it in like kind of a communal setting. And it just really stuck with me, and I've kind of been on chasing those types of experiences, both for myself and opportunities to help facilitate them for others for the next 25 plus years of my life, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had another question here. I think you kind of answered it, but you know, why do you find value in guiding people in the mountains? And when I think about guiding, you know, there's kind of two ways to think about it. And I think in this day and age, sometimes people are after just kind of consuming these experiences, right? Like to be in the outdoors and for whatever motivation. But I think sometimes it's driven by social acceptance, right? And I think as a guide, you can bring a lot more meaning to these experiences for people, other than just providing them exactly what's on the brochure. You know, you've made a career out of doing this. And I think from what I've heard, you excel at bringing meaning to these experiences for people. What are some ways that you kind of tap into that, or how do you approach that?
I think for me, how I find value in guiding, to answer your question, as well as, you know, how do I tap into that meaning for other people, is I guess I was just, you know, I was raised in a fairly large family, 4 brothers and sisters, and kind of public service, community involvement was always a very kind of common theme in my family, to kind of help others and try to make a part of your purpose in life to use personal skills and experiences to help others and impact others' lives in a positive way at like a very broad, high level. So for me, I find value in guiding because the experiences of being in the mountains did a lot for me as a person. They taught me a lot about myself and, you know, where my limits were, how I reacted to situations, how I approached the world when there was some danger or consequence, you know, where my actions had real meaning, and as well as the you know, the bonds you form with people and the community around that, and then just these incredibly inspiring places on the planet that it's taken me. So that's always been the value for me, and therefore being able to try to offer that experience to others is how I guess choose to find value in guiding for me. And then the other part of your question, how do I tap into that? I mean, it's really pretty simple, I guess. I just try to listen and be present with folks. I think that for sure there's a trip on the brochure that people sign up for, and I could, you know, whatever that trip might be, a day of rock climbing or skiing or, you know, climbing Mount Rainier or whatever it has been in my career. I could certainly make sure to just deliver on that. But I think the other part of it for me is really like the relationships that are formed with people on these experiences, because it's such a powerful environment, and a lot of I would say like the formalities or things like that, that people hide behind in their day-to-day lives is really stripped away. And you kind of see people for who they are, and, you know, including myself in that statement as well. And I really just appreciate getting to the meat of it and just seeing people for who they are and getting through the facade of all the other bullshit around, you know, normal life that those environments bring. And therefore, really trying to tap in and see who people are, meet them where they are, listen to who they are, listen to their stories, you know. I'm there to provide an experience to maybe, you know, deliver what's on the brochure, but I'm also really there for them. And so I guess my tactic is to just really listen and hear what people's stories are and what they really want to get out of an experience like that in the mountains. Because for sure, for folks to spend the time and money and energy and training and fitness, there's something deeper than just the feather in the cap. I believe that. And therefore, taking the time to get to know people and hear and try to understand what it is that drives them beneath that is really important and a great way to connect with people. And I just think it's really important. A lot of people in this world, you know, don't really have the opportunity to tell our story a lot of times and have people listen to us. And from that, I feel like it makes me a better guide and have more of an ability to react to where people really are at and what they want on a deeper level, and then do the best that I can with my skill set to try to deliver on an experience like that.
Mm-hmm. So in 2007, you had been living in Crested Butte for, I think, quite some time and had gained some mentorship from some folks in the community at that time, and you ended up buying the guide service that you worked for, right? Crested Butte Mountain Guides. You were 30 years old and you had this opportunity to buy the company and start running it. And we've spoken a little bit before this interview about how you felt like if you had wished it was 10 years later, in some respects, like maybe you weren't quite ready for it. And I think that's a common theme in our industry, is that these opportunities present themselves and you don't always feel totally ready for them. Right. And, And so describe kind of the growth process that you went through personally and some lessons that you learned from buying and running Crested Butte Mountain Guides at that time.
Man, I'm still processing the lessons 15 years later. Yeah, it's true. You know, I was in a position where I had been doing all the ski town things to make a living. I was ski patrolling part-time. I was part-time avalanche forecasting at the Crested Butte Avalanche Center. I was doing a little bit of guiding. I was still kind of traveling around nomadically, working for guiding companies and occasional outward bound course and doing all the things to piece it together. And was starting to feel a little like, God, there's got to be something easier, you know? And I've now, one of the lessons I've learned from that, to not jump too far ahead, is being okay with having to like reevaluate and recommit to this career path. And I think that was my first real situation that I had to face. Like, am I really going to be able to make this a career, or should I throw it all away? It's been fun and it's time for me to go back to school and get a real corporate job. And now, you know, 15 years on, I've realized I've had to have a few recommittals about this path and myself, which has been very valuable. But I think that was kind of really the first one for me, was when I was presented with the opportunity to buy the company from Alan Bernholtz, the previous owner. It was like, I was thinking about doing something else. And I saw that as like, well, maybe this is the last opportunity to really make a living here at this career. And I would be remiss if I didn't admit that I didn't really buy the company. Alan, owner, financed me the company, and then clients and friends and some family basically bought it for me because I didn't have any money at the time. And it was a little bit of an eye-opener, especially clients of mine that were willing to kind of fund a loan, so to speak, to buy this, that they believed in me. And they said that, you know, we believe that, we think you'll do a good job here, and we'll offer some advice along the way. And so I went into the deep end of the pool there and took the company over and slowly like stopped ski patrolling, slowly stopped avalanche forecasting, started in earnest to go down the AMGA road to try to live a little bit of what I wanted my guides to do. And in many regards, I look back now and feel like I got an MBA through having to run the company. And it was really hard at first. It was super scary, the feeling of being indebted to a lot of people that trusted me. It felt like a different level of trust than guiding, which was interesting. Like, in some regards, in guiding, your people are entrusting their lives to you and your decisions. And as a 20 something year old in early 30s, I'm like, wow, I don't know if people should have done that. At that time, I still had a lot to learn. But then is something about the pressure of like a lot of money and people's maybe expectations a little bit on that, and put a lot of pressure on me that I felt much more burdened than just taking people out in the mountains. So it changed a little bit of that perspective for me. Was it made being able to take people in the mountains, it felt like a little bit simpler and more cleaner line of like what I can control and what I can't control, and really focusing on the things that I can control and trying to just plan as best I can to be able to respond to the things that I can't control. And the business taught me that, because it felt like it was much more a world of a lot of things I couldn't control. And I had to learn different frameworks of how to kind of manage that stress and that feeling of like being a little bit over my head and in a world of a lot of things I can't control. And also things that wouldn't necessarily give me direct feedback. So if I made business decisions or hiring decisions or marketing decisions, like I wouldn't get the immediate feedback you would in the mountains of like, oh, if I ski this slope here or go this way, I'll get immediate feedback on if this was the right decision or not. So it was a little more of that long-term learning process that I had to get comfortable with. It was also really intimidating to go from working with my peers to then all of a sudden being like the employer of my peers. And man, I that was a really hard one, because I had a ton of respect for the people I worked with. I felt like some of them knew more than me. We had a really good core crew of some really high quality ski guides at the time there in Crested Butte, and most all of them have gone on and become IFNGA guides now. And it was really intimidating to just all of a sudden be now in charge. And I tried really hard to, I guess my goal was to create as much of a kind of a family community atmosphere as possible. And I really just saw myself as sitting at the steering wheel, but everybody was kind of driving the bus together. And it taught me a lot about, you know, the teamwork and the idea of like organizational culture and how much that can lead to success. And I would say, like, on paper, I had the company for almost 9 years and then I sold it, and on paper it would look very successful, but I still really feel like it was more of a communal effort. I just happened to be the one at the steering wheel, but we kind of all made it a success together.
And what do you attribute to that culture that you helped to create there?
I think it was just a culture of being open-minded and listening and, you know, being willing to be vulnerable enough to be humble and to be like, I don't have the answers, and to not pretend, so to speak, that I had them, and instead be honest with my staff and my friends and the other community members of like, this is my goal or what I'd like to do, but I don't have the answers here. And I'm more hopeful that by surrounding myself with really good, smart, passionate people that we'll find the answers together. And, you know, I'd like to think that that's what led to some of that cultural success, was just being a little bit willing to be vulnerable there.
That's a really good segue into something that I was planning on talking about later in the hour, but I think we should talk about it now. I've really enjoyed some of your contributions to the Avalanche Review in the last few years. In the April 2021 issue, you wrote about group communication and decision-making tactics. And it seemed like you kind of took a deep dive into kind of like looking at businesses and how they communicate and how they make pretty hefty decisions and some of the factors that go into that. And you did a great job of drawing some parallels between business organizations and operating in an uncertain environment, let's say in the backcountry ski operational context in a guiding operation or ski patrol at the ski area. I really liked how you framed kind of two different ways of communicating. One is as a form of advocacy, so kind of like advocating for what you think is going on in the backcountry, versus communicating through inquiry. And I was hoping you could maybe unpack that for our listeners a little bit.
Yeah, that's thanks for reading that article. I was in the depths of grad school, you know, kind of almost like right in the heart of COVID too. And, you know, I went through grad school and I did a master's in organizational leadership, and I just could not help feeling like the experiences in the outdoor community between guiding and ski patrol and forecasting and the things that we deal with in these uncertain environments that are high risk, high consequence, kind of fast paced decision making had like so much. It was such a rich kind of laboratory of experience to bring into this more kind of higher level, just organizational leadership. So I found myself reflecting a lot on my experiences in the mountains as good examples, and being the only person in the program that kind of came from that background. And it was a pretty diverse program. There were a ton of corporate people in there, but also military folk and things like that, that it offered a really unique perspective and kind of made me double back on my own life and realize like, wow, these skills are pretty phenomenal that we have to employ on a daily basis in the mountains. And the communication piece really spoke to me because it made me reflect a lot on some experiences in my career and have to look at, I guess, break down maybe a little bit more the processes and some of the teams that I had worked with to understand the mechanics behind a lot of the successes or failures or difficulties or things when things went really well, to use those examples in writing papers and things like that in this course. So looking at things through that lens was when I kind of stumbled upon the idea of inquiry and advocacy and communication, and how a lot of businesses that are successful will really, you can parse down the research and it kind of shows it has a lot to do with the organizational culture and how these teams communicate with one another. And arguably the way the world is going these days with more and more remote teams and things like that, it's becoming, organizations are becoming much more flat. And how important communications are in kind of developing the framework for organizational culture. And so in looking at it in the mountain kind of community that we come from, I guess the idea of advocacy is something that doesn't always work well in the long run. And I started to reflect back on my life and thought about, like, well, how have I experienced this idea of advocacy communication? And I started thinking back to like morning meetings on ski patrol or at guide meetings where like people were just dug in on their perspective. And that's that advocating piece of the component. And they just, all the data is a little bit confirmation biased to support their point of like, I really think we need to open this terrain today and this is why, or I really think we don't need to open this terrain and this is why. And communicating from an advocacy mindset or perspective can be quite powerful to get a point across and certainly useful. But the teams that tended to, in my experience, that tended to really communicate from that way, by the end of the season was a little exhausting, because it was a lot of headbutting amongst characters and personalities throughout the season. And it would kind of felt like it fractured the team culture a little bit, where everybody was just exhausted with working with everybody else. And because you know you're going to start butting heads with someone when the decision making starts to get difficult or complicated, there's a storm cycle and you're trying to figure out how to manage instabilities, and people are all advocating for their perspective and they're not open-minded enough. And there were close calls that happened because of that. You know, people were wrong, as we all are. But it was also like, took a lot of mental taxing energy to kind of always operate in that community, so to speak. And then I thought about the places that I worked that felt very empowering and almost like easier mentally. And at the end of the season, I wasn't so like fried and over it and was just like, take me to the beach and let me sit in the waves kind of thing. And those tended to be these cultures or groups or teams that communicated with a little bit more of the inquiry mindset of trying to be open-minded, trying to ask for different perspectives, putting yourself in other people's shoes, trying to see things from, yeah, someone else's point of view. And really having this inquiring, inquisitive mindset and trying to really understand why somebody is coming from their advocacy place. And I started to realize that those environments made me feel just a little bit more comfortable with also being somebody that was learning along the way in this profession. And I think we've probably, a lot of us that have been in the game a long time have started to, we probably feel like, man, the more I know, the less I know a little bit, you know, continuously get surprised. And so I thought about, wow, the people that I've worked around that have helped me grow as a professional have been these people that have kind of approached me with this inquiry mindset, where they've really asked for my perspective and they've kind of dug into why I think that, and they've been open to hearing about why I think the way I do or what data I have to back that up. And it made me feel much more comfortable being vulnerable and learning, but also a little bit more energizing in those environments. And so I guess that inspired me to kind of reflect back and put that article on the TAR on like how important it is for team culture to differentiate between these two mindsets or communication styles and understand which is at play there. And there's certainly times for advocacy, but realizing that, like, is it being used around a specific event, or is it being used more as a communication style by a personality throughout a season? And like that arguably is a drain on a team's performance. But there are certain times where advocacy might really fall into place for like a certain event or storm cycle. And that might be what it takes. Someone's like, no, I've seen this before. I've been here for 30 years. These are the other experiences I've had with this type of storm cycle and this terrain and this, you know, I really think it's this way. And I think when someone communicates with that advocacy, but it's not their go-to or their default, then it has much more power on the decision-making for the team. And ultimately, I would hope that a lot of this communication stuff helps us make better decisions.
Yeah, it's so important, and it takes a certain level of emotional intelligence to question your motivations behind your communication style, right? Like, and buy in from everybody, but we can really only control our own. And so I think what you're speaking of is like trying to foster that culture within organizations to come from a place of inquiry and ultimately hopefully creating a safer work environment because of it, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting because I would argue a lot of us are in this profession in the outdoors, guides or forecasters or patrollers, because we don't like to be told what to do too often. And we like to have a lot of influence on our decision-making ourselves. And we like to feel empowered and not boxed in. And that's the beauty of this profession so much. So it can be hard to take on a different mindset of being more inquiry-based versus advocacy-based. And it's certainly easy to talk about this theoretically when you're over a cup of coffee, but like when you're out in the field and it's storming and then having to really try to like bring the communication style in place is much more challenging. And it made me reflect back, like my early mentor at Crested Butte, Alan Bernholtz, who I eventually took the company over from. You know, Alan was a ski patroller. He was the whole impetus behind the Crested Butte Avalanche Center. He was a heli guide in Alaska. He went through the AMGA ski guide program way early on and was trained under Jean Paviard, who was also still happened to be around when I was there. But I can remember the first times going skiing with Alan in the backcountry. He would just grill me about, you know, what I thought about the skin track here and what do I think about the snowpack. And he was just always almost interviewing me. And after a little while, it felt like, wait, I thought this guy gave me a job already. And like every time I go out and ski with him, I'm being interviewed again and again. And it felt like pretty stressful. But then I kind of called him on it at one point. And then that's when I realized like, oh no, Alan's actually like trying to give me a platform here to share what I'm thinking to help his decision-making to get a different perspective on it, as well as if he knows what I'm thinking coming from, it allows him to then kind of teach or mentor to what I'm missing pieces wise in the equation. And once I kind of understood the whole background behind that, you know, and that was totally Alan was using this like inquiry mindset, in communicating with me to just kind of tease out information and make it be an okay place to learn, to share, and for him to understand, you know, where my shortcomings were as a young guide in terms of my understanding of stuff and be able to like kind of fill in the gaps for me. And as uncomfortable as that was, once I understood it from the other side, it made sense. I feel very lucky now that I had an early career experience with having like an inquiry communication mindset be so effective.
That was a great story about that mentorship there, and appreciate you sharing. So Jason, you've had your fair share of injuries on the job and in the mountains. How has that kind of spurred you to diversify the portfolio, so to speak, and kind of like look at other ways that, you know, we can't always be mountain guides forever. Bodies break down a bit. And so what have been some events that have kind of spurred you to think about, you know, going to get your master's degree or looking at other avenues, other jobs within the industry as your career continues to evolve?
Yeah, I think a lot of those decisions have been somewhat inspired by injury, downtime, and reflection, and fear-based, feeling really vulnerable, like, you know, you're a mountain guide and you're infallible, and then all of a sudden something happens and you're injured, and now you're like, oh, I'm actually, you know, much more vulnerable than I thought I was. So I, you know, during my lost college years there, in between the punk bands and the sports, before I kind of found the whole outdoor industry, I went on a little bit of a philosophical kind of quest in life to understand. I had a few friends that were killed tragically, and in my younger years, and I wasn't brought up with any kind of religious framework or structure around the purpose of life. So during that time in my life, I'd also cast it off down the road of exploring religions and philosophies, and spent a lot of time in like Buddhist meditation retreats and centers and stuff, and actually worked at this little restaurant and where I went to college with some Tibetan monks, and got into all that. And so I think it ingrained a little bit in me this kind of ability to use downtime as reflection time and introspection, and that's a little bit of a gift in some regards. So then when I've had injuries or things along the way, I've kind of used that as like, oh, this is a time for reflection and introspection, and maybe like a re-examining of my path, and as opposed to just, you know, I'm going to double down and get back to what I was doing. So the master's degree came from COVID, actually. When COVID kind of shut the guiding world down, I transitioned, like a lot of other guides, to doing some of the online skills, Zoom clinics and stuff. And I realized fast that this was not for me. Really, what was important to me was like connecting with people in the mountains, in the environment, and not through screens. So I used the COVID thing a little bit as like, oh, this is a time to re-examine, reevaluate, some introspection. Like, maybe I can set myself up with some skills to build on, to have some career trajectories or exit ramps, however, down the road, including right to where I am now. I would say like my job that led to being an A3 was from blowing out my knee as a heli ski guide in Alaska and having a year on the couch, having to recover and kind of get back to doing these things to reflect on, like, okay, you know, I'm in my late 40s now, and I have to work really hard to get back to where I was, and do I really want to work just as hard to get back to doing what I was doing, or are there different paths or doors here that can lead to other avenues along the way?
It seems like you have some really good tools that you've developed over your life to kind of build some resiliency around your identity. You know, it can be pretty fragile if you put all your eggs in the basket of being a mountain guide or a ski guide, and then that can so easily be taken away through an injury or other life events. And so it seems like you've done a great job of being kind of just some honest reflection about that and kept other opportunities open. Good lesson for us all. So let's talk about your role as the A3 Rec Education Manager. That's a new position within the A3, and it's awesome that there's funding for that. Maybe you could just give us a high level summary of the state of recreational avalanche education in the States. It's been evolving over time, and there's a lot of providers out there that are offering recreational avalanche education. I think a lot of times people think of kind of the big six providers, but there are many, many other organizations that are offering avalanche education. So give us a summary and let us know how the A3 fits into all that.
Yeah, it's been a new position for A3 that obviously was the board and the leadership of A3 felt was needed, and they fundraised for and then advertised and hired for it in September. And I kind of found myself in that role. And it's been pretty eye-opening from someone that's been in the avalanche education game and professional avalanche worker for 20 something years, and having started my career, yeah, with Aerie, and then worked with SAS for a while in Silverton, and then AI more recently. That the whole recreational avalanche landscape is way bigger. I was also a little bit naive to that as well. I think right now there were about 70 providers that have been A3 approved for recreational avalanche education. And I think that the time has certainly become needed where A3 needed a dedicated person there to kind of oversee all of these providers and holding them to a little bit maybe more accountability in regards to quality control and standards, and are the people really meeting the guidelines. So that's been a little bit of the motivation there. And I think, I guess my thought or inspiration or hope and how I kind of approach the role is more not to come in as like the compliance cop for the first time, as much as like, hey, if we can offer as the national governing body here, with education being one piece of what A3 does, if we can offer some standards and some accountability and some processes to put all that in place, it will ultimately make the whole avalanche education industry that much better, and will weed out the people that aren't meeting certain professional standards, hopefully, and kind of weed them away and really get a lot of people on board with like, this is what it means to be A3 recognized as a provider, and just raise the whole bar. So that's kind of the hope with it there, as well as starting to reevaluate, you know, what the current guidelines are for what's taught in recreation education, and are they working, and are there ways we can make this better, and can it fit and flow into the pro world a little bit better. And you know, one of the big components that I've been tackling is the motorized community, and how do we kind of set up guidelines around recreational education for the motorized community specifically that will allow that industry, I think, to kind of grow into what is probably going to become needed or wanted in that industry for the next 10 years.
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect of it, because you know, much of avalanche education did stem from skiing and snowboarding, right? And for a long time, we've been trying to just kind of like fit that into the motorized community. And maybe that wasn't the best approach. And maybe it was the only approach at the time, but it's great to hear that there's being some focus brought into that. What are some strategies or areas for improvement or ways that you all are tackling that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty fascinating to see what's happening in the motorized industry. And, you know, I've been a motorized user in the sense of being a hybrid user, where I've just used it to get into deeper skiing with less tracks, but certainly am not an expert snowmobile rider. But I see what's happening in the industry right now a little bit, similar to what happened in like the backcountry ski industry probably 20 years ago. Like when I started my career as a guide, which was 98 99, I was on a split board because I was a snowboarder for a long section of my career. And I mean, I think that was like the Vole split decision was the only option, or you made your own at home. And it was awful. Just it was a really clunky, not great tool to kind of move into the backcountry with. And I found myself going back to skiing, which I'd grown up doing, because I was like, man, this is just so much easier to get around. But now, 20 years later, like I see clients that come out and split boards, like the technology and how light things are. And then the backcountry gear, you know, from the old Raymer bindings to the Fritchies to now everybody's got pin tech bindings. The gear has made it so much easier for people to get into the backcountry. There's just that much more out there. And we've seen it in the avalanche education world just exploding. And I see that happening in the motorized community now, or just in the last 5-10 years, the machines have gotten so powerful and so much easier to operate, so to speak, that it can get people deeper into avalanche terrain much quicker than it used to be. So I think that the whole avalanche education industry around motorized users is just lagging 10 or 20 years behind what happened in the backcountry ski non-motorized world. So if we can get ahead of that a little bit at A3 to really have some guidelines around what that education looks like, then hopefully it will allow providers to start to build their own curriculums and things that offer very high level quality avalanche education to reach these motorized users. Because as we're seeing, they're starting to become more and more statistically the people getting caught, unfortunately, and has a lot to do with the tools they're on. So what I have, I guess one way I have approached this for A3 is pretty much the first 3 months of my role has been reaching out and connecting to the motorized community and bringing them all together in a group, a kind of a working group we started to review the guidelines that were originally created by A3 in 2010 and then really like not touched since, and to see like, are these still, do they still make sense? Are they still applicable? Or because of the growth in motorized users and more people wanting to teach motorized specific avalanche education, do these guidelines need to change, and how courses are offered or the curriculum or things like that, that the A3 kind of guidelines can set the standard for there. So it's, I'm certainly not the expert, and I've seen much more of my role as bringing a lot of the experts in the industry together, and then hopefully I can just facilitate the discussion, and then from that we can tease out what the next steps there would be to look like to really create somewhat of a separate tract or whatever, even if it is very much the same, that just allows the motorized community to access avalanche education that much easier and higher quality, hopefully.
Hmm. Do you think providers are hitting the mark with the Rec 2 these days? I've kind of felt this, and since the ProRec split, that like the whole idea was to try and better serve both the professional and the recreational communities, and I kind of feel like the Rec 2 sometimes maybe misses the mark, and it's a bit ambiguous, and is it really like the right step forward after a Rec 1? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. And I've heard that from a lot of the avalanche ed community, is that once the pro rec split happened, that Rec 2 became this nebulous gray dead end a little bit. Like, where does this really go? So that is certainly pretty high priority to, like, again, gather a lot of the providers that are out there and people that are teaching these courses and be like, does this need to be rebranded or restructured into a professional Rec 2 kind of thing that becomes like a pre-Pro 1 track that's maybe more snow science based, or, you know, you could take the other module, so to speak, that would be more like higher level kind of rec decision making there, and that becomes more of the end point for the recreational user, or maybe leads to a Rec 3. I don't know. I don't have answers there, but I certainly feel like it's become this kind of black hole that people don't really know what to do with. And it's a little bit empowering to feel like I'm in a position now where I can maybe help change that a little bit. Also intimidating. And also, you know, having been a guide, I am certainly aware that now in my role at A3, it's to be successful in the long run, it's really not just me making decisions on how things need to be. I really have to bring in the greater community here and facilitate the right path out of discussions with them. And it's really my goal to just put it to paper a little bit, but the greater industry is really what should determine what that road should be, which obviously is much slower than that probably a lot of us would like. And that's the part that I bump up against from my guiding background, of just having to have the patience there to move an industry versus just an individual.
Sure. Do you have an idea of like how many non A3 providers are offering recreational avalanche education?
I don't. And one of the goals that I've had is part of this oversight is trying to put some pieces in place where A3 can start to gather some data to understand like exactly how many students are being taught on a national level through, because up until this point, a lot of this has all been just like honesty reporting and if people feel like it, but there hasn't been someone tasked at A3 with asking for this kind of data and then collecting it and being focused on it. So one of my roles is to try to understand on a broad level, like how many people are going through avalanche education that's been A3 recognized on a national level, and who are those people? We can start to understand that stuff a little bit better. And then I think once we have a lot of that baseline kind of data, then that allows us to make more informed decisions about how we change curriculum. Or, you know, there's a lot of, to this point, it feels like there's been a lot of, God, it feels like, or it seems like, but there's no hard data behind that. So if we can start to find some of that hard data, then it can help us start to figure out, like, okay, how many people took a Rec 2 as it is now in the country that through A3 providers versus, you know, a couple years ago, and then, or down the road, and then how do we better change that program or change the trajectory of how people move into the pro world or the needs for more recreational level beyond a level 2. So I think hopefully it's my goal to kind of start gathering some of that data from some of the providers. And that just comes from like building relationships with these people, to be honest, and being available to communicate and be responsive. And then as A3 can start to gather that data, it'll allow us to better plot the future.
Yeah. Well, Jason, it sounds like you've got your work cut out for you, and I'm glad they found the right person for the job. And I'm sure that you're surrounded by some very supportive team members to help you navigate this new position. Just looking back on your career, Jason, have you had any close calls or accidents that you would want to share with the listeners that you know, maybe changed the way that you operated in the mountains?
Yeah, I mean, I have certainly had a few close calls. I would like to think that all of them have changed a little bit of how I operate in the mountains. There's two that I can think of that had a pretty lasting impact on me. I can start like chronologically. One was probably 15 years ago now, when I owned Crested Butte Mountain Guides. And I was selling some ski mountaineering camps in the springtime in April. And, you know, we really wanted to get into like technical crampons and ice axe, couloir climbing and rappelling into ski lines. And that was kind of what we'd sold. And I'd been doing that program for a few seasons and it had slowly been growing. And we had a really weird spring stormy cycle of like warm weather and poor freezes, and it just, the snowpack was not really set up for that type of terrain. We were not in a corn cycle. It was too early. So I canceled this ski mountaineering camp, which was thousands of dollars. And, you know, the end of the ski season there as a small business owner, that was like kind of a big loss to accept. But, you know, I was like, man, it's just not set up for that. And then a bunch of locals started going out and skiing a bunch of big lines. And I had a lot of second guessing there, like, oh man, did I like pull the plug too early here? So I went out and skied a line with my girlfriend at the time that was, it's called the Pencil for those folks that have been in the Crested Butte backcountry, but it's like north facing terrain, right at tree line, steep, 40 plus degrees. Has kind of a big bowl feature at the top that wind loads and has a couple different aspects from northwest all the way around to a little bit northeast. And then the whole thing funnels into a couloir very similar to like the terminal cancer couloir, just shorter but steeper. And we had had a cold snowstorm and it was springtime. And so I went up there with her and was like, man, people are skiing a bunch of the stuff. And this was one of the lines that we were going to ski, and I was feeling like I'd been too conservative and was second guessing. And we get in there and I go into the starting zone on a rope and dig a couple pits and find there's like a wet grain layer on a north aspect at, you know, 11,000 plus feet in Colorado in the spring. And it's buried about 12 to 18 inches down under dry snow. And I identify there's wet grains on a north aspect, like, that should have right there just like raised the hairs on my neck. But I did a bunch of stability tests and they weren't really reactive, wasn't propagating a lot. It was all loose, kind of low density snow on top. So I was like, the wet grains are there, but they don't seem that reactive. And we drop in and we ski the upper bowl in like two short pitches. And right as all this is happening, it's like warming up and greenhousing. There's like this cloud layer that comes in, which is kind of rare in Colorado. You know, it's not like a maritime climate at all. And there's like this low, hot kind of cloud spring layer that's re-radiating and greenhousing the snowpack. And as soon as we get into the couloir and pull up on the wall of it, part of the bowl behind us just spontaneously releases on those wet grains and goes full track almost 2,000 feet through the couloir and right over our ski tails. And we're in the fog and I can't see my girlfriend at first. And I'm convinced, you know, I hear her yell and I'm convinced she's in this slide. And I'm like, you know, before it's even stopped, I got my beacon out and I'm like ready to turn and start searching. And then I hear her say, I'm okay, I'm okay. She was just scared. And we were up on the wall of the couloir, thankfully. It had a little bit of a half pipe feature and allowed us to kind of get out of the gut of it. And, you know, I was just like, holy shit. Like I felt super exposed and vulnerable. And I was like, we got to get out of here. But it was white out, cloudy conditions. So we kept skiing this couloir in a short pitches, leapfrogging and pulling up on the side of the wall. And it happened once more. The other part of the bowl spontaneously released again while we were in there. And again, it like ran over our ski tails and luckily we weren't caught. And we get out of there and I'm just like totally rattled because I almost feel like I just killed my girlfriend who entrusted me as the guide, obviously, to make the decisions. And I had like put a lot of weight on these stability tests and was also very much feeling the pressure of like, I'm being too conservative with my decisions. You know, I had this whole business pressure behind me. And the couple lessons that I took from that one, obviously we were okay, but I like went back and looked at all the weather stations and the remote weather stations in the area, and they'd all spiked in temperature by a couple degrees just during that hour we were up there because of the greenhousing effect. And it had just completely like weakened that bond from the new storm snow to the wet grains and made it all release on the wet grains. And was super lucky. So the couple lessons I took, I guess, were one, I gained a real healthy distrust of wet snow stability and just predict the stability of wet snow grains. It was like, I was way too cocky about that. And I got lucky. That's all there was to it. And then the other piece was probably like perfect travel techniques as you learn, like, you know, one person exposed at a time and like as far out of the path of the track as you can get, even in that kind of really confined terrain where a safe zone seemed like very marginal thing at best, was probably what kept us not getting caught in the funnel of that thing. And it also taught me that like it's a little bit of the details, like how you do one thing kind of matters how everything happens. And that I had made one big mistake in assessing the stability of the wet grains, but I had then still continued to like make good decisions on travel techniques and stopping points. And had I made one more probably little mistake there, it might have been a much different outcome. And so it also kind of hammered home to me how important all the little small details are to also do perfect, because you're probably not going to get everything right. And that when I'm having to make decisions and assess stability and like kind of high consequence terrain, that like you're probably not going to get everything right. And if you don't, you know, if you don't get a few things right, it's going to be pretty catastrophic. So that has stuck with me through my career for 15 years since. For sure, one of the major learning points. And I had at the time turned that into a case study at Crestview Mountain Guides the next winter, and kind of opened our guide training with that case study of just, you know, overconfidence in unfamiliar snowpack conditions in that kind of terrain and that climate for what we were used to in Crested Butte, and how the importance of just dealing with anomalies, how we have to really be super conservative, and shared my process of why I was even in there in the first place and how, you know, I was kind of lucky, and the importance of the travel techniques too. So that's certainly one experience.
Yeah. So it seemed like you kind of made that initial decision to cancel the ski mountaineering course, and then it sounds like you were influenced by people that were out there skiing bigger lines. You know, it's interesting how we can kind of like that whole uncertainty factor, and then seeing people get away with it. I know for myself that influences me, and it's hard to just walk away from that and not go skiing when other people are skiing, right?
Yeah, the whole social proof kind of pressure thing, right? Yep. You know, I mean that. Yeah. It's interesting because my other lesson that I learned more recently, being the heli guide in Alaska, was, you know, I got hammered by my slough, which is like, you know, rule number one in Alaska: don't get hit by your slough, and blew my knee apart, unfortunately, in the process. And I've been skiing in Alaska for almost 15 years, and a lot of it was ski touring and heli assisted ski touring. And I was always very resistant a little bit to get into the heli ski guide world because of that kind of pressure on the guides from the clientele. And it was just something I didn't really want to enter into. And then I found an operation up there that made me feel comfortable with, I guess, being up there and maybe not having as much of that influence. And then in the end, to be honest, like, it still got me. And it was like, you know, clients that wanted to push it a little bit more than conditions were probably allowing for. And I was skiing for weeks on end with not getting a lot of feedback. And, you know, just kind of like misinterpreted the terrain and the sloughing hazard getting worse, and let myself get pushed into a little bit maybe inappropriate of a line from that social proof again. And that's what kind of led to me. Thankfully, it was just me that got injured, not any clients. But again, it was like, damn it. I've been doing this for 25 years and I still have a lot to learn.
Yeah. And the mountains and the snowpack don't really care, do they?
Not at all.
Yeah. Well, Jason, thanks so much for sharing those stories and some of the reflections on your career. And I implore all the listeners to go check out this, well, all of your articles that you've written for the Avalanche Review. They're all good. There's another one on that's titled On Managing Uncertainty that I really liked as well. So I'll provide a link to those in the show notes, and listeners should certainly check those out. But thanks for taking the time to sit down with us today, Jason. And it's been fun to get to know you a little bit more, and hope to see you out in the mountains soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Caleb. It's been a real honor to be on the show. I've always gotten a lot out of your Avalanche Hour podcast guests, and it's just, yeah, it feels really honored to be on here. So thanks for wanting to chat with me a little bit.
Yeah, of course. We'll have hopefully it turns on in Colorado for you soon, and everywhere else as well. And yeah, we'll catch you on the skin track.
Sounds good. Thanks, Caleb.
All right. Cheers.
Yep.
Thanks for choosing to spend your hour with us. The music on today's episode was provided by Ketsa. You heard the tracks Head in Clouds and Century. Find more of Ketsa's music for your next project at ketsa.uk. Our artwork was provided by Mike T. Thanks, Mike. Check out more of his work or get in touch at miket.com. Are you ready to step up your tour planning game? Will McKay from Mountain Mapping wants to help you. Mountain Mapping EDU is a digital education platform on backcountry navigation, covering all of the popular mobile navigation apps. There's over 8 hours of digital content for you to work through at your own pace. Whether you're taking your first tour into the backcountry or a seasoned veteran, you'll be sure to pick something up in its content. As a listener of the Avalanche Hour podcast, Will wants to give you 30% off your annual subscription with the code TheAvalancheHour. Find out more at mountainmapping.com. That's mtnmapping.com. Thanks again for listening today. We appreciate your support. If you're enjoying the podcast, give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really does help. If you got any feedback, comments, concerns, questions, you can reach out to us with an email at theavalanchehourpodcast@gmail.com. Give us a follow on Instagram. We are at theavalanchehourpodcast, and that's the best way to keep up to date on the newest releases of new episodes. Join us on March 15th as I share a great conversation with the director of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, Ethan Green. Until then, stay tuned, stay safe, and keep having fun out there. See ya.